afternoon. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing Policy Committee. We are looking forward to more members beginning to sort of filter in, but I would like to begin our meetings as close to on time as possible. I also want to make note that the clock in here and the clocks that the rest of us have are not aligned, but we're going to work on that. According to my watch, we're about 5 minutes after the hour, and I think that's enough time to give people to float in. And I want to begin because we have the privilege of hearing from Commissioner Jessen, who is here, is not on the agenda, but wanted to come and make a statement to us, and I really want to accommodate to that. Welcome you to stay for the whole meeting, of course, but because you've made that effort, I want to make sure that we're using your time wisely. So please approach us and look forward to your comments.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me set the stage and provide a few brief comments before you hear from our assistant commissioners as they kind of provide an overview of the different policy areas. It's okay with
microphone. There's always acoustics problems. And
thank you. And for the record, I think they would, even though we all know who you are, that the record is reflected in an audio way that you are here.
I apologize, Madam Chair. I'm Lucinda Jessen, and I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. And if you have trouble understanding me, I apologize. I have a cold. But I was hoping, with your permission, Madam Chair, just to highlight a few of the policy issues that I think we all will collectively be talking about and you'll be considering. I know that there's some that are budget-related. And I'm not trying to provide a comprehensive list, but I thought that if I just highlight a few things that I think will be coming up from our perspective, that might be helpful to the committee as you heard the presentations from the different program areas. So that was my goal, if that's acceptable to you.
It's more than acceptable to me. I'm hoping that today, because we had some wonderful presentations in the health finance division, that probably will replicate some that's here. We have different members, not some are the same, some are different. But people were eager to engage in the policy discussions in a variety of areas, and I'm hoping we have the same kind of enthusiasm to have more of that dialogue than simply about this concept of what it is we're trying to achieve and where we're going in DHS. So thank you very much for this.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't go extensively over the Affordable Care Act because I know that there was a meeting about that last night, and I was sorry I had another speech I was giving and I was unable to attend. But obviously, implementation of the Affordable Care Act and moving forward on health reform, and particularly from a policy perspective, what we do with our Minnesota Care Program, are important issues that face us. But as I said, I'm not going to say more about that, just other than to obviously state that that is an important issue, policy issue. We'll be addressing this session. Another major issue from the department's perspective is our Reform 2020 efforts. And I just wanted to kind of say a few things about what that was about. I know that Assistant Commissioner Coleman will go into more detail, but just from the department's perspective, that is a major priority for us. This is really a hard look at a comprehensive redesign of much of our long-term care system, especially our home and community-based services. And I was delighted that this committee also includes, oversight of housing, because so many of those efforts involve housing. And while we need to get approval, kind of waivers, as you know, from the federal government for part of this, we're actively in those discussions. So I just hope to say, wanted to highlight for you what I think of the importance of the overall package. Some of the package you'll see in bits and pieces. And so sometimes it's a challenge to say, look, what are all these moving parts? So I wanted to take the opportunity to tell you from a department perspective where we're trying to go with this. And as you know, the home and community-based services, serving people in their home is where people want to be served in most circumstances, and it's also a very growing part of the state's budget. So what we are trying to do is really look and redesign our system now in a way that's budget neutral now in this biennium, if you look at everything. So there's some parts that cost money, some parts that save money. But in the long term, we think that by 2020, when the age wave hits, the wheel of redesigned a system that will be more sustainable in the future and will better serve people. And we're doing that in some major ways. One, to try to intervene earlier So this is not about taking services away from people. It's about intervening and reaching people earlier with a wider variety of services that can help keep in their homes so that fewer of them need to go on to our expensive waivered programs. We're not trying to take anything away from those programs, but we have waiting lists for those programs, and those are where we get the most extensive set of services. We think that if we tailor our services more to the individual, give them more options, make it more consumer-driven, where individuals have more choices, you know, and are deciding what service providers they want, what services they want, taking more responsibility where they want to for those services, as I said, intervene earlier, having a broader array. We keep people in their homes, in their communities, instead of waiting until they maybe qualify for those waivered services, and then we need to. It's too late to do some of the things that we could have cut earlier. Some other parts of that really involve housing, and I'm not going to go through all of the parts of it, but I just do want to highlight that what we're trying to do here is pretty unique. We're asking the federal government for permission to use Medicaid dollars to help provide housing and housing supports for people, for example, people with serious mental illness, people who are homeless. We think we have a track record from some of our demonstration projects that show that we save federal and state taxpayers' dollars because we keep those people out of the emergency room and our expensive health care system. So there's a lot about the housing components in this as well as employment, that we really want to provide more early on employment supports, especially to people with disabilities, to help get them and keep them in the workforce, and to intervene earlier so fewer end up going on SSI. So there are a lot of parts of this, but I wanted to highlight the importance that we see, you know, for our state really to redesign now. Because I think sometimes it's easy to say, well, there are no budget dollars because it's budget neutral. But if we do it right in this biennium, we really, I think, are setting the stage for better services and savings in the long term. I promise I won't say that much about the other policy things I want to just highlight, but that was an important one. Regulation of methadone clinics, I think that's something that you'll be hearing from us about, and I think from others as well. Methadone is appropriate, way to address some of the heroin addictions and other things that we see, but we need more oversight of those providers, and that's something we want to be talking with you all about. Transitions from some of our state-operated services is another big bucket of matters that I think is very important. We have people, especially in Security Hospital and some in Anoka, who are there today who could be cared for in the community. And I think we need to look at our system to better design it so that happens where it should. You know, because it's better for people, often better for, you know, the bottom line. And it's also, and I mentioned this, part of kind of the way we're thinking about what they call this Olmstead planning. And Olmstead's a Supreme Court decision that says that it talks about the need for states to work to where we work with people with disabilities to make sure that we serve them in the most integrated way possible, the most integrated way in our communities. And that's just not a matter of healthcare. That's really talking about where people live, but where people work, and where people play. So it's all parts of their lives. So we are taking a comprehensive look at that as a state at that, and certainly some of the things we need to look at in our system is part of that. And so I think just wanted to put that on your radar, that I think is an issue that you'll probably be hearing from us about. Kind of related to that is really a hard look at our continuum of care in our mental and chemical health areas. You know, we know that where we have some real successes, we also have some gaps. And sometimes people end up in one setting, sometimes a more expensive setting, a more structured setting than necessary, because we have gaps in coverage or care. There's some reports. You'll receive a report on the continuum of care in our chemical health area, I think is due in March. But that's something that I think, looking at those continuums, is something I'm hoping that we can, you know, talk about, and I think you all will want to think about this session. You know, the recent shootings in Connecticut certainly highlight kind of some of the needs, and people have talked about it in gaps. We've been looking at that over the past year. You know, where do we need more access to those critical, you know, mobile units in our state? You know, where do we have good coverage? Where do we have problems? So I think that's kind of some of those policy issues that are going to be important. Another one that maybe seem a little drier, but we certainly need to address is our waiver standards and payment methodology. And this is a matter of federal compliance. The federal government has said we are out of compliance and has recently told us very clearly that unless we finalize and pass in law these new standards for our home and community-based providers and the methodology by which these providers will be paid, that they will not renew our waiver. And so this is something that we've been working on and has been before the legislature in the last year, but we really do need to address this session. Just looking at my notes to see what else I have here.
Senator Jess, while you're looking for your notes, on this community-based services rate setting and standards, what is the critical concern for the committee's information? What is the critical thing that needs the little tweak or adjustment?
Madam Chair, it's more than a little tweak. Several years ago, CMS said that we are out of compliance as a state because we are doing these provider contracts by county. And they said we have to, as a state, be doing this because there was a lot of inconsistencies in the way that the counties were doing this. And so this is really that effort. We've been doing a lot of work with stakeholders in the counties. And Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman can give you more detail about that. But I wanted to highlight it because from our perspective, it's one of those, must get done, matters. So moving from something that maybe doesn't sound, that high profile to something that certainly is, I want to allude to our sex offender treatment program. I think that as most of you all know, while from a DHS perspective, we run the treatment program. We don't decide who comes in. We don't decide who leaves. But I think that is a program where some work is necessary. Senator Lori is on a task force that has been appointed kind of jointly by me and the federal courts to look at this issue. So I think we'll probably be hearing about that. So I just mostly wanted to get it on your radar. That I think that will be an issue before this committee. Child care providers. There's several issues I think we see coming up with child care. I think we all know the value of a good education and how important it is and how often those early child care providers are with parents, together with parents, the first teachers for our children. So you'll hear about some changes that we'd like to make to our program, including increasing access to quality child care, but also a way of a lot of streamlining in our programs that we think needs to happen in our child care. And you'll hear some about that in our infant program as well. Moving forward on county redesign work, this is really building on work we've done in the past, but we do think that we really need to continue to move forward towards kind of an outcome-based performance system. We've been working closely with the counties on a lot of this. You'll be hearing about that. But I think that is certainly something that is moving in the right direction. And I think will help the counties and the state to think about what should be the appropriate role of counties versus state government in a lot of these human services systems, some of which the way we designed our county-state system was kind of drawn up back when they had horse and buggy days. And so I think we do need to take a look at the role of counties in the state and also to think about how do we get better outcomes. And can we do that with our current system or do we need to do things differently? But I think having the outcomes in place will give us a good structure, good framework for having that conversation. So those are the things I just wanted to highlight for you that, don't necessarily have budgetary impact. Some do, obviously. But I think are some clear policy issues that we think will be important. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have, Madam Chair, committee members, or turn it over to
Commissioner. Some of these are conversations, so they're about creating an agreement about a vision, a direction. That takes time. Some have moved further along, like Reform 2020, where I expect that we will see specific pieces of legislation. Other than Reform 2020, as the, for example, the homestead issue, is that of these that you've highlighted, where do you expect we will see the department present some legislation?
Well, I think there's, Madam Chair, I think there certainly will be legislation, you know, in the childhood, in the child care area. There certainly will be legislation in the around, I think, some of the pieces of what I'd say is the some of the Olmstead concerns. You know, I talked about really looking at the transitions from Security Hospital in particular and how do we move that forward. There's some things we can just do as a department. There's some things we're going to need some statutory changes on. I think, though, what I would hope and suggest that I think taking a broad look at the Olmstead issue, kind of the you'll see a few things this year, but I think it is an issue that will keep coming back to us across the years. So getting a broad understanding of what the parameters of that law are would be, I would suggest, helpful. This is something where the Justice Department has taken a lot more active role in the last 2 years, you know, actually suing states, saying that states are not doing enough to when they serve individuals with disability, to serve them in an integrated way. Now, our state is far ahead of most states in this. You know, we were last year awarded the state, you know, said we were number one in the country for home and community-based services, which includes, you know, people with disabilities. But, you know, certainly we have a ways to go as well. And I think doing planning on that so we don't end up, you know, as some of those other states do with, you know, lawsuits and whether we should be moving ahead to serve the people because it's the right thing to do. So we'll have a few pieces of legislation on that, but I think it will be building towards the longer-term goal. I think on the issue of sex offender treatment program, we really are looking towards the recommendations from the task force, you know, to inform our thinking, you know, and so I don't think you'll initially see us with litigation, but really hoping to hear and take some direction from the task force. I'm now trying to remember the other things I listed, Madam Chair, and whether there would be specific legislation on them or not. Methadone clinics, I think we'll have some proposed legislation, because we do think we want to clarify the standards and move them into our state statutes, because we think the ambiguity there has led to unnecessary problems in some of the methadone clinics in our state.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, good to see you. On the methadone legislation, my hope is that it's not just a reactionary, that it's well thought out. I actually, I was telling Senator Lurie this, I actually went to a methadone treatment clinic just the other day, and that's quite a field trip to see that. So my hope is that we, if there is legislation, that it's done very thoughtfully and make sure that we are able to continue to provide treatment for those that absolutely need it, and methadone is the only way of providing that treatment, because obviously it is working if one of the largest treatment centers in the country is adopting it. But my question is to the community-based outcomes that you were talking about. We've done some pilot programs in the past for redesign. Are you going to, I'm sorry, I guess I wasn't really clear, are you going to adopt more of a statewide approach to combining some of these departments, you know, county services, that they could be working together better? Is that going to be becoming a mandate or a law going forward, since it's only been a pilot program in the past?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, let me address the methadone question first. Senator Rosen, I certainly agree that methadone, we need to continue to have methadone available, you know, as a treatment option. We have, you know, as the senator knows, a real, you know, increase in, you know, heroin trafficking in the state, heroin abuse, substance abuse, and methadone is one tool that we need to have to help address that. And it is effective for a number of people. But we do need, I think, to be able to continue to have that, we need to do a better job regulating. So we are trying to walk a fine line here. We want to be able to continue to have good treatment providers in our state. We need them. But we also need to minimize how methadone being able to get out and being sold on the street, so it contributes to our drug problem. With regard to some of the county outcome work, this really builds upon legislation passed several years ago. My understanding, it was before my time as commissioner, so many of you will know this better than I do. I think there was a question the legislature. Do we just tell counties, you know, let's only have 15 counties, or let's have a kind of top-down approach to we ought to reorganize and be more efficient? And instead the legislature said, no, let's kind of instead, and I think you all worked with the counties on this, let's try and create outcomes we're going to hold counties to in the future. And if counties can't meet those outcomes, like, for example, an outcome being how many children in your county are in out-of-home placements, you know. If you can't meet outcomes that are in place, then, you know, one, you'll get kind of a warning. But after time, if you can't, then the commissioner has authority to either, you know, come in, I don't want to plan to do this, and, you know, take over, or at least assign that some of that work in the county to a different county or have them join a coalition. So I think our current approach, we do not want it to be top-down. We want it to, but we think if we have agreed upon outcomes, and we're working very closely with the counties on this, and counties see then that they're at risk of not meeting those outcomes, then counties themselves will be more likely to say, do we need to do things differently? From my perspective, I think that's a much better approach, and that's certainly the approach that I'm taking as commissioner, not top down, but we do need to focus on better outcomes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for being late. I had some radio to do. But and perhaps you mentioned this, Commissioner, but any focus on long-term care issues, what we want to do with that? I sat down with the department earlier on the critical access nursing facility legislation that we passed last year. I'm looking forward to being able to talk about that. Full disclosure, but I think that has great potential. But do you have anything specifically you want to work in that industry, which is in a crisis mode?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. And I wasn't trying to give our whole kind of budget here, and I was trying to think of some of the high profile policy issues. But certainly, you know, I want to continue to work in our long-term care area to improve it. And I think that's a lot of what our Reform 2020 package is about on the home and community-based service side, that is really a major redesign of much of our long-term care system. But I do think we also need to look at how we build in more incentives for quality for both our nursing facilities and continue to do that, as well as our long-term care, as well as our home and community-based service providers. So those would be some of the things that would be important to us to continue talking about.
Thank you.
What's encouraging about this conversation is you'd have to, I don't know what stratosphere you'd have to be living in if you didn't understand that we were going to be facing, a crisis in long-term care, whether it's in the highest expensive facilities, which we'll continue to need, or community-based services, to not have a plan in place that receives this huge influx of customers instead of reacting to that. So it's really important and encouraging that we're going to continue to have strategies beginning now for dealing with that. Other questions for our commissioner? Well, I really appreciate your coming and being here with us. This committee will be reviewing these and creating the policy that will then move, you know, and poor Senator Laurie and his committee will have to find the funds for it. So we hope that this is a very thorough conversation and discussion about how to progressively move towards the goals that we have.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I look forward to working with you.
Okay, so we can begin our agenda. Announcements, I would like you to notice that we've provided some more information for you. One is a list of committee procedures that we'll be following in the meeting. I'd like you to have a chance to sort of review those. And then we have a one-sided sheet of a cheat sheet for you to be able to check back if people start using letters rather than words, and I get lost trying to remember what those letters stood for, and I stop paying attention to what the person is talking about. So to the degree that as you come and present for us, this is for everybody in the room, if you at least give us one swipe at the full term and then let us know, like you do in a paper sometimes, say for here out, I'm going to call it this, But this is what it stands for in the first place. It helps us from have, at least me as the chair, continually going back and taking a look at what we're talking about. So that's among the things that are your materials. I'd like you to keep them and save them and have them with you for our meetings. Okay. We will move now to a review, an overview, program overview from Children and Family Services. Commissioner Aaron Sullivan Sutton, Assistant Commissioner Aaron Sullivan Sutton, will be presenting. Please introduce yourself for the record, and I appreciate hearing what you're going to talk with us about. Let me also, in this conversation, encourage you to talk about this from a policy perspective, and then I'm hoping that what we have and what I'm asking from our members is a conversation with you about that. I found that as we did this in the finance health policy, it was very engaged. People were very engaged, and we would love to have an opportunity to talk about how people from the committee are thinking about this subject area as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to that as well. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Children and Family Services at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. You do have a handout before you. I'm sharing with you some materials and a lot of data that I shared with the Finance Committee yesterday. I will not be talking from this.
This room has real gaps in hearing. I know, especially over where Senator Nelson is, it can be very, very difficult in the past to hear what's being said. So,
okay,
you know,
if you try to talk closer to the mic.
That's perfect. Thank you.
So you do have a handout that has a lot of data and figures that I shared with the Finance Committee yesterday. I will refer to pages as I go through the discussion, but my plan is today is to not talk from this, but to give you a more plain, what I hope is a plain English overview of the programs and services in the Children and Family Services area, and to have a dialogue with you as we proceed. The Children and Family Services Administration is responsible for services to promote better outcomes for some of Minnesota's most vulnerable children and adults. Our services are directed at at-risk children and adults in adverse conditions due to abuse, neglect, extreme poverty, disability, and those at risk of becoming dependent on public programs and services that are more deep and costly. Research has demonstrated that investing in early childhood care and education and development, preventing child abuse and neglect, and assisting people in meeting their basic human needs are fundamental to ensuring healthy and productive development of our citizens. In doing our work across the administration, we balance the need to reduce expenditures and to align limited resources with those services that have proven to be effective in improving outcomes in the lives of people served and reducing the downward trajectory that would otherwise occur. And what you will hear me repeatedly say throughout the conversation this afternoon is the importance of using data and evaluation and measuring performance so that we can continually improve the services and outcomes for people we serve. This is work that does not occur in 1 year or even 2 years, but we really need to take a longitudinal approach to improving service delivery and outcomes for vulnerable people. Common themes across the programs in our administration, we have to have the flexibility to respond to families where they're at, regardless of where they enter the system. Where they enter the system because of financial need or because of child abuse and neglect issues, we need to be able to have a response that's tailored to where they're at on that given day. We need to have targeted and data-driven investments. We need to pay for what works and stop paying for what doesn't work. We need to be able to help meet families' needs for concrete supports in a timely fashion. That's critical, again, across program areas. And we need to support and facilitate people having access to community resources where they live. And we need to agree on outcomes and measure progress toward achieving those outcomes. I should also say, when I talk about this and I say we, I refer to the collective we. We work very closely in partnership with our counties and tribes as well as other providers and recognize our joint responsibility to having service delivery in a way that is best responsive to the needs of individual children and their families at the service transaction level. A number of pressures that we have identified that have been a challenge to us that you will hear more about is the challenge of bringing successful early intervention pilots to scale for at-risk children to reduce deep end, more costly services that disrupt the development and well-being of children. Minnesota is very good at pilots. but we have a very difficult time bringing some of those pilots to scale, particularly when those pilots have demonstrated to be effective, and I'll talk more about that. We have seen benefit levels that have been stagnant for many years and have not kept pace with the cost of living. We are challenged with maintaining current critical computer systems that are necessary to serve clients on a daily basis while developing a new enterprise architecture as we move forward. And as you know, our systems have been consolidated now under Minute. And as we work to modernize our systems, that's a challenge in service delivery. We also know through some of our reform efforts over the years that we are most effective when we are targeted in our efforts and when we use research to drive improvements in our service capacity and delivery system. I'll talk in a few minutes about some of the significant reforms we've seen that have been demonstrated in the child safety and permanency area. And we have seen significant improvements in child safety and family functioning from our family assessment redesign of our state's child protection system. We also know the importance of using early childhood education research in order to obtain large long-term gains for low-income children across populations, whether they're served by programs in the Department of Human Services, programs in the Department of Education, or programs in other agencies. We need to look at what we've learned from welfare reform research. The largest impact that we can have is for the most disadvantaged families. We know that extreme poverty in the early years of life has the most adverse impact on the development of small children. We also know that, conversely, modest increases in income have magnified positive effects on children and their healthy development. I'm going to talk a little bit now about some of the work that we have done in reforming our child welfare system in the area of child safety and permanency. Again, this is some work that has occurred over a period of a number of years and continues to move forward. For over a decade, Minnesota has been a national leader in reforming the child welfare system. The focus of our reforms has been on early intervention with families to reduce child maltreatment and avoid more costly, intensive, and intrusive services later. Institutionalizing this approach to practice within the child welfare system in Minnesota has been challenging because counties fund more than half of the cost in the system. Minnesota is very unique in that we rely very heavily on property tax dollars to support our delivery of our child welfare system in Minnesota. The counties benefit from this approach in terms of long-term savings, but also have to provide upfront investment in very challenging and budget times. And I'm happy to report that they have stepped up to the plate in providing resources to help do this further this work. One of our major child welfare reforms resulted in a statewide implementation of a flexible child protection response system that includes what we call family assessment and family investigation, responses to accepted reports of child abuse and neglect. Family investigation response is applied to the most serious reports of harm and neglect to children. Family assessment, on the other hand, focuses on family engagement with families and services being provided to address child safety concerns and mitigate the risk of subsequent child maltreatment. Minnesota counties and the two tribes that provide direct child welfare services apply family assessment response to reports that meet screening criteria that you have provided through Minnesota law that do not allege substantial child endangerment. There was an extensive 4-year pilot of this approach from 2001 until 2004, and we had a statewide approach beginning in 2004. The focus of this approach is really to engage in families' protective capacities and offer services that address the immediate and ongoing safety concerns of children. Family assessment uses a strength-based intervention and involves the family in planning and selecting services. It's really about engaging families rather than blaming families for the care of their children. About 70% of the reports accepted for child protection are now assigned for family assessment. As I mentioned, there was a...
70%, so that's 30% that are not?
That we have a more traditional investigation where the focus is on, did the parent maltreat a child, and then what services are needed. Part of this was, historically, when a child protection report was made, the agency went out, and the first question that was asked, did you maltreat your children? So as you can imagine, that started an adversarial relationship between the agency and the family. And what we've learned, that wasn't a very effective approach to responding to families, particularly when most families are trying to do the best that they can. And so we wanted to have an approach that was more positive, strength-based, that really went to the, so the worker goes out to the family and talks about receiving a concern about safety of children and engaging the family in a conversation that's much more positive and helps families do what they need to safely care for their children.
Yeah. I think I understand what you're saying. You're using an asset-building approach.
Right.
And so, so I think that's, you know, I'm supportive of that. Most families would welcome, you know, experts coming in and giving ideas. I certainly welcome that in my office. And but there's 30% then that you make a determination that that's not the appropriate approach. Is that what you're
correct.
Saying?
So that there's a more of a forensic investigation, fact-finding, determine if somebody maltreated a child, and then services after that. I mentioned that there was an extensive evaluation. We followed families for 3 years and then 5 years. And what we were able to demonstrate is that this new approach has improved child safety, reduced recurrence of maltreatment, improved family satisfaction, and increased utilization of services. Families actually engaged in more services if they were under the threat of losing their children.
Does anybody have any questions about that? I'm just going to slow you down so that, you know, I think people are very interested in it. Is there any, at this point, anybody wants to ask something? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question is about the topic right before this, which was the child care. So I don't know if you want to address that now. I think you might have gone by that, or if you'd like to take that question at the end.
I'll be coming to child care.
Okay. I'm reading ahead. Sorry.
Great. Okay. I, you're talking 100 miles an hour.
Okay, I'll try
because
to
you have a lot you want to tell us, but I want you to know that people are anxious to converse with you.
Sure, so, absolutely. Well,
and some of
that.
This it comes off like brrr, okay? So, and we want to have a chance to slow it down, and
okay.
If we don't have it today, we're going to have you come back. But
that would be fine.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so what was learned through the family assessment response was the foundation for another program, what we call the Parent Support Outreach Program. And that's an early intervention program. We, again, did a pilot. It was a 3-year pilot, began it in 2005. And what the idea there was, if we could provide the similar sort of approach to families who are reported to Child Protection, but on that particular day, their situation wasn't bad enough to come into Child Protection, but could we provide a voluntary offer of services to families? And what we do know, so we piloted that. We currently have that program operating in 38 counties and 2 tribes where there's reports made to Child Protection, but as I said, the situation isn't bad enough on that day. But those families do have significant exposure to child maltreatment risk factors. And we know that without intervention, these risk factors may be realized in a future incident of maltreatment or abuse. And if we provide services to address the child maltreatment risk factors and unmet family needs that threaten family stability and safety and the well-being of children, that we may be able to make a difference. We know from the National Incident Study on Child Abuse and Neglect that children from families in poverty are 7 times more likely to experience neglect and 3 times more likely to experience abuse. This voluntary program allows the county and tribe an opportunity to respond early to a broader set of families and to prevent conditions that are harmful to children. Again, the program evaluation showed significantly lower child maltreatment re-reporting rates for families with high levels of poverty who are receiving substance abuse prevention and employment services as compared with families who had similar issues but didn't receive any services. Interestingly enough, about 50% of the families who are offered services accept services, and pilot counties experienced a significant decrease in overall child maltreatment reports in these counties, making the most significant investment in PSAP, those counties achieved about a 9.6% reduction in reports. The program made a difference, and it works. The majority of families also reported satisfaction with their involvement, and in fact, 2/3 of the families reported that they experienced marked improvements in the problems that they were experiencing. We saw reductions in determinations of child maltreatment will have an important impact on reducing the number of children entering and remaining in foster care. And we know that children in foster care tend to have poorer life outcomes. So we're looking for opportunities to keep children safely at home with services that help their families care for them. In this area, we, with your support and work, we have also worked to support the increase of tribal capacity to provide their own child welfare services. We currently work with Leech Lake and White Earth American Indian Nations to provide direct child welfare services for Indian children and families on the reservation. And you have provided state funds, $4 million in state funds, for them to provide a comprehensive array of child welfare services. And in addition, we have worked with them to access federal funds to help support their service delivery. And I'm happy to report that the two tribes are achieving outcomes with respect to children not experiencing repeat maltreatment and actually are exceeding state performance on children reentering foster care and reunification. And so having culturally specific services for kids and families living on the reservation has made a difference. In the area of child welfare, in addition to prevention and early intervention, we focus a lot on permanency. We recognize that some children do need foster care, and the hope is that children can be reunified with their family in a timely fashion, but unfortunately that doesn't always happen. In some instances, the parental rights have to be terminated, and the state has made significant gains in the adoption of children under state adoption in the last 10 years through a variety of initiatives, including a partnership that we've had with our judicial system since the year 2000, work with counties to concurrently plan for reunification as well as permanency if children can't be safely reunified, and other initiatives in the area of adoption. And as of September of 2012, there were 814 children under state guardianship, which was down from over 1,700 in the year 2000. So that's been significantly reduced. And of the 814 children under state guardianship, almost half are in a pre-adoptive home. And we continue to look for adoptive families for those that yet don't have resources. I'm also happy to report that children and youth are spending 36% less time under state guardianship waiting for adoption. We are down from 747 days to 477 days, and that's important because we have an obligation to make sure that kids don't grow up in foster care and that if they don't have the ability to return safely to their families, that they have another permanent family in their life so that they have the same stability and support that we would want for our own children. Now,
you're going to move on to child care now?
Yes.
Before you go into that, I can see that there's a lot here in your presentation on child development services, child care, child support, work supports, and our time is almost up for this presentation. So what I liked about your presentation on the safety of children is that you're talking about outcomes, but I think I'm going to have to ask you to highlight just at the 50,000 level on these and allow us to have some time to interact with you about the things that we have questions about.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And this is more for your information. I'm not going to share all the detail of this. I'm going to just do the high level. So in the area of child care and child development services, we look for ways to make progress on three primary goals. One is increasing access to high-quality child care for our poorest children. We want to support early childhood and school-age quality care in ways that strategically promote positive outcomes for children and provide families with information and program quality. And we want to link effectively to other services and supports for children. This is an area of work that we work very closely with the Department of Education as well as others in the Office of Early Learning as we look to braid resources for families to have access to high-quality care. The Child Care Assistance Program pays a 50% higher rate for children in accredited or credentialed programs, and about 21% of children receiving child care assistance are enrolled in this type of program. And what we want to do is continue to encourage families to use high-quality care and increasing choices for parents. We are working to expand the Parent Aware, which is a pilot quality rating and improvement system across the state over the next couple of years. This is a rating system that gives parents more information about the quality of care of providers so that they have more choices. And this is an area that, again, we're working very closely with the other state agencies. We also work with the Department of Education and Head Start directors to support Head Start programs to provide enhanced full-day services for working families by braiding child care assistance funds with Head Start funding. Some of the issues and challenges here that I'll just mention briefly are child care rates and some of the reductions in the child care program over the course of this couple of years, and the need for streamlining and some simplification here, and we'll be talking with you more about that.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have a great memory. Commissioner, I would like to visit with you just a little bit more about the Parent Aware and the high-quality child care. That is so important because 90% of brain development is before age 5, and we have a significant number of students children that we help subsidize that child care for. And my question would be the expansion of that. I see that it looks like it's about, if I'm looking at the numbers right here, out of the $203 million that we spend for child care assistance programs, we spend about $10 million on the child care quality piece. And so my question is, where are we on making sure that all of the state dollars that we spend on child care assistance are going to high-quality child care? What is the status of that, and what might be holding that back?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, one of the things that we will be talking with you about is some initiatives to further encourage parents using high-quality care, whether it's an accredited program or programs that receive higher ratings on the quality rating system. I should also mention that Minnesota, as you may know, Minnesota received $45 million in the Federal Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant, and a large part of that work is to roll out Parent Aware statewide so that we have an increase in high-quality care throughout the state, both with family child care as well as child care centers.
And Senator Nelson, follow-up.
Just a quick follow-up. And so I want to make sure that we're not just limiting Parent Aware or high-quality child care to new money, but I'm interested in the money that's already being used for child care also be used for high-quality child care. And so if I understood you correctly, are you working on Parent Aware for all of our child care subsidies?
We're looking at Parent Aware, Madam Chair, Senator, we're looking at Parent Aware for all providers who want to be a part of the system. One of the things that we have to balance in the child care assistance program is where parents choose to use care and where care is available. So for some families, they will choose either legal non-licensed care or licensed family child care because of the hours they work or where it's accessible. And what we're trying to do is create a system that encourages and provides resources for families to be able to pay for high-quality care, which is expensive, but also recognizing that we don't want to risk having our poorest families not have access to that. And so working with families on some of the choices that they make as well, and recognizing that some of this takes time as we move families. What I can tell you, and we'll have some information released shortly, is that we are seeing a reduction in the number of families on our child care assistance program who are using legally non-licensed care. And that's the direction that we're hoping to see.
I'll follow up later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, very quickly, I want to mention some efforts in the child support area. We are working with a number of reform efforts in child support that I'll just go over very high level. One is we just completed some work to simplify the process for modifying child support orders and to help families have an online capacity to application that they can use as they as they need to. We also have a number of strategies to help low-income families. Using first strategy is to help families by taking more time with individuals entering the system to understand the child support program and to make sure the order is right up front. And then secondly is work with families to make sure if the order is kept right. So if there's changes in family circumstances, that can be corrected in as timely fashion as possible. And then third is to work with individuals where there's large arrears. In some instances, there is credible evidence that the person doesn't have the ability to pay, and we need to recognize that we may need to have opportunity for forgiveness or offer repayment options and make sure that those non-custodial parents continue to have involvement with their children. And try to work more closely with the father's network and advocates to make sure that there's information readily accessible to dads throughout the state.
Mr. Commissioner, is this program still one in which a percentage is charged against the recipient of the child support for the payment of the program?
That's correct.
And it's the one who receives the income, not the person who is delayed or delinquent in paying their child support.
Madam Chair, let me get back to you on that detail, if I can, just so I make sure I'm clear.
It's not fully funded through that, but there, or is that a fully funding of the initiative of child of the cost of the child support program?
No, it's the child support program is currently paid 66% by the federal government, and then there's a combination of state and local funds for the remainder. I want to turn very briefly to work support programs. Minnesota has been a national leader for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And the Minnesota Family Investment Program provides temporary work supports and graduated work and financial incentives to give poor families a ladder out of poverty and welfare dependency. MFIP is a work program, not a welfare program. Employment services are mandatory for participants, and participants are required to create an employment plan and to participate in 20 to 40 hours of work or work-related activities each week. In recent years, we have increased the use of supported work as a means of helping participants to develop skills and experience so that they can obtain employment. We have worked to develop an assessment tool to use statewide to increase jobs counselors' ability to identify and address barriers to employment and to help do what's needed to help people get back to the job market. We also have worked to create what we call the self-support index, which is a performance measure unique to Minnesota that really focuses on long-term outcomes rather than compliance activities or processes. It measures the percent of adults who are off cash assistance or working 30 hours or more per week 3 years after the baseline quarter, and it's a very important way of demonstrating that families that are actually moving to work. You hear a lot about the work participation rate, which is really a compliance federal measure that is related to whether families are engaging in certain activities that may or may not lead to employment. And so we really want to be focusing on measuring whether people get jobs. There are a couple of challenges in this area that I know you're aware of. One is the grant level in the MFIT program has remained the same since 1986, and there's also families have experienced challenge with a family cap, so if there's a new child born in a family who's on the program, there's not an increase in assistance.
Assistant Commissioner, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there because we're falling behind. This is obviously, you had more to tell us than we gave you time to do it in and for us to have a conversation with you, but we may be inviting you back again.
That would be fine. Thank you very much for
your
time.
I appreciate it. Now we're going to move to continuing care. Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, I would just ask you to try to keep your comments to, are we going through? At least, it means high level, 20 minutes, overview of the policy, not the detail, where it is we're trying to go, to allow the members of the committee to have a chance to direct the questions and get you to answer what they're interested in rather than just the overview, okay? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to do so. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care Services at the Department of Human Services. You have two handouts that I'll be working from. One is a 16-page handout that will form the basis of our discussion. And then you have a one-page, two-sided document that shows some of the funds that are distributed through through long-term care for seniors and people with disabilities.
16 pages is a lot for.
I will be brief.
Okay.
I will be brief. First, I'll draw your attention to the last page on the 16-pager, which is another set of acronyms that are specific to long-term care services. So keep that as a reference tool also, and I will do my best to avoid speaking in our terminology. Continuing Care manages long-term care services for seniors and people with disabilities. We are structured in four divisions: the Aging and Adult Services, Disability Services, Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and Nursing Facility Rates and Policies. You will see some themes that throughout many of our initiatives and much of what we talk about on the front page, which tries to articulate a vision for people of all ages that enhances community membership, health, wellness, safety, your own place to live, long-term relationships, control, consumer control over supports, and employment. We have a very large role in spending, $3.6 billion annually in state and federal funds. And we touch about 350,000 Minnesotans on an annual basis, some with some very small touches, some with certainly a lot more higher need, extensive services. We administer the Medical Assistance Program, Medicaid, in Minnesota, and that is where the bulk of our spending occurs, but it's certainly not all of our spending. We provide a tremendous amount of information, and that is one of our key strategies to help consumers make good choices, to make sure that we are there when they need us, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the document. We have institutions. We have nursing homes. We have intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities and day training and habilitation services. We have a significant role in assuring quality, evaluating and measuring what we're doing, and sharing that with you and the public. We have partners within our continuing care programs: the Minnesota Board on Aging, the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, and then, of course, we work with many stakeholder work groups. So what is long-term care? Long-term care is both institutional services as well as home and community-based services and supports. A significant but certainly a changing component of what we do is in the institutional sector, and that has been a trend that has been driven by policy in the state of Minnesota for the last 20 years, and we continue to see that trend. It's driven by policy. It's also driven by consumer preferences and consumer choices. So we have nursing facilities that continue to downsize, continue to assess the marketplace and adjust to their role in the health and long-term care system, specialize in some cases, whether it's post-acute care services or dementia services or other kinds of specializations. We see that shift that's occurring throughout the state of Minnesota with our nursing facilities. And I know we will have many questions about how that's working and what the future holds for that part of our long-term system and support sector. Similarly, we have a downsizing of the ICFDD, the Intermediate Care Facility for Developmental Disabilities. And on page 3, you'll see that trend line of how that part of the system has been changing. And again, this is in concert with a movement to a more home and community-based service system and inclusiveness for people with disabilities. Trying to be brief on some of these things so we can have a discussion. On page 4, you will see that the trend line on spending on the institutional side of our business has been relatively flat and will continue to be so, if not a decline at some times with even the number of people that we're serving. The length of stay is shortening in our nursing facilities because their role is changing. Moving on to the home and community-based waiver programs, just briefly, the waiver programs are a arrangement we have with the federal government to use not only our money, but, excuse me, the federal government money as an alternative to the institutional care. And that's what we call a waiver. There are 5 waivers that we currently manage with our federal government: the brain injury, the community alternative care, the community alternatives for disabled individuals, the developmentally disabilities waiver, and the elderly waiver. I'll note on the elderly waiver, we purchased that through health plans. So we contract with the health plans to manage that portion of the home community-based service system for our older adults. On page 7, you will see the participants to give you a sense of scope. How many people are participating in each of these waivers? And on page 6, you'll see a description of the various waivers and who they are intended to serve. What we spend on waivers, you will find on page 8. So again, you can see a sense of the size and the scope of who we are supporting. And then you will see the monthly cost per recipient. And we have other documents that can show you some of the trend lines of that cost. They are growing. They grow because we are serving more people. And the needs of the people that we serve are also increasing.
And Commissioner, so, may I ask a question on the waiver? I know there's been battles in the time that I've been here about increasing the number of waivers in these various waiver programs because of waiting lists or people or service providers wanting to offer these services. Is that continuing to be a problem? And is the waiver system set up in a way that it's an amount of money that can be used in a variety of ways? So is the waiver has to be spent per individual, or is it an amount of money that then can be maybe shifted over to expand the number of persons that are served because two people might require less than one under a waivered service?
Madam Chair, lots of questions in there. I'll try to remember them all. Only 2 of our waivers currently have enrollment limits: the developmental disability waiver and the community alternative for individuals with disabilities. The other 3 waivers do not have enrollment restrictions. So first we'll zero in on those that do have enrollment limits. Those are growth limits, and it's a decision that's made each legislative session about how many additional dollars will be put into those 2 waivers. It does not necessarily restrict the number of individuals that are served within the waiver. We manage those waivers through the counties. And if the counties can find less expensive ways of meeting people's needs, then they do have the flexibility to add people into the program. We try to facilitate that through policy. For example, we have a moratorium on corporate foster care beds, which is our more expensive version of how people receive services in the disability waivers. So by limiting the growth in that area, we're trying to incent the provision of alternative forms of service that meet people's needs. Another example, we have a housing access program where we have contracted with a provider, with an organization to help people move from ICFDDs, Intermediate Care Facilities for Developmental Disabilities. You understand why we go to acronyms sometimes. as well as corporate foster care or adult foster care, who express an interest in moving, and we have moved over 600 people into homes of their own. Similarly, we have strategies for people who want to leave nursing facilities, the Return to Community Initiative, which again is intended to help people who express an interest in leaving and returning to the community but need some additional support, some additional planning in order to make that happen. And then we track them over time to make sure that we don't have people going back and forth. So we're successful. There are waiting lists on the two disability waivers that we currently have enrollment restrictions or growth restrictions on. It does not mean that those individuals necessarily are going without supports or without services. They can still receive, for example, personal care assistant services to help them remain independent in the community. We have priorities that we work with the counties to try to enroll or address the needs of specific populations on the waiting list who are of greater need than others. It's a very challenging task to try to meet the needs of people who are on the waiting list, but we do have strategies and we do work with the counties to try to do so. I hope I caught most of what you asked.
That was
about.
Helpful. If there's anybody else who has a question, is this reference to the Olmstead issue? Is our position as being better than other states related to the fact that we are engaged in the activity that you're talking about now, but we're being told it's not enough?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Olmstead is a relevant conversation that we should have. We have, as a state, been moving toward community inclusiveness for a number of years. That's why you see the not only the people served, but the dollars that have been shifting from an institutional basis to a home and community-based basis. We have work left to be done, and that's what the Olmstead committee that was formed during 2012 worked on making recommendations about what the state should do better to include people with disabilities of all ages in the community. And then we will have a planning process to develop a documented Olmstead plan. With all due respect, I think the topic itself deserves a hearing.
Okay.
So we can talk about it more in more detail.
But would it be fair, Assistant Commissioner, to say that what that Olmstead committee is working on is to talk about more than location of a person's housing? The waiver provides various services to keep people in the most community-based living situation that they can, but it would expand that to integrate other kinds of programs like work and maybe continuing their education, or it is a broader set of services that surrounds this program. Is
Madam
that correct?
Chair, you're absolutely correct. It is more than where someone lives. That's an important component, but it's not the only component of community inclusiveness. So we do want to address employment of people with disabilities, competitive employment. We do want to address, do people with disabilities have the opportunity to be part of the community, to socialize, to integrate with people that do not have disabilities. So if we think about what our lives are like and the choices that we have, how are we able to meet those aspirations for people with disabilities in the structure and the choices that they have? Could be education, could be employment, could be socialization, all of those things. And that's why it's a state initiative. It's not a DHS exclusive initiative. We certainly provide a major role, but we will have to work with many other state agencies to improve our inclusiveness for people with disabilities.
Oh, thank you for that. I won't keep you on that. I know you have other things to talk to us about, but this and Reform 2020 and a number of things that we're talking about here I think are important. Yes. I hope that in this discussions, if you're involved in them, you'll remember that I'll be asking about what the state of Minnesota as an employer is doing to be a partner with the disability community, because I think that we have a lot of speak about integration of persons with disability into the workplace, but I don't know that we can reflect that we've made an effort to do that in all the places that we employ people in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, be happy to have that discussion also. Moving on, page 9, touch a little bit on alternative care. Again, it's one of the strategies that Minnesota has used for a number of years, actually to, again, keep people in their homes and to help support people who, without this program, would exhaust their resources and would have to go on medical assistance. So this, again, is a lower-cost way of helping manage the state budget. A side note, part of what we are discussing with the federal government, what we're trying to make the case for, is that the federal government should participate in this program. They do not currently. This is a state-funded only program. We believe that we can document and have documented that we have saved the state money and correspondingly have saved the federal government money by helping this small part of our older adults stay in their homes. And that's a discussion we're having with the federal government right now, asking for federal participation in alternative care. Another part of the continuing care administration is deaf and hard of hearing services. And on page 10, you'll see a description of that. These services are primarily distributed through regional offices throughout Minnesota so that we can be closer to the consumers who need these supports. We have a very targeted and specific program for people with mental health needs who are deaf and hard of hearing. And we also are responsible for managing the telephone equipment distribution program, which helps people who are deaf and hard of hearing and deaf blind receive services and technology to help them remain independent. And then we have a new one, the National Deaf Blind Equipment Distribution, which we were awarded a small amount of money to work with that population. And it gives you some statistics about how many people we serve, how many people we provide information to throughout Minnesota. Aging and Adult Services grants. So now we're moving outside of the elderly waiver and the alternative care. We have a number of programs, again, targeted to older adults in Minnesota to help them remain independent. You see some examples of that: nutritional services, congregate care meals, home delivered meals, groceries, et cetera. Another significant part of the work of this activity is the community service development grant work, where we're trying to build the capacity, we're trying to build the services so people have access to those programs throughout Minnesota, as well as support family caregivers, and provide chore and assistance with activities of daily living, etc. All designed to help people remain as independent, which is what we hear most from older Minnesotans. They want to stay in their homes as long as they can. And we believe that it certainly saves money and is a win-win situation. You see, part of this program leverages some volunteer activity, as well as we manage the senior linkage line and the one-stop shop, which I hope you have heard about over the last year, providing good information to older Minnesotans as well as their families to make choices about how they're going to receive services.
I think the Reform 2020, Assistant Commissioner, is related a great deal to this as well. One of the initiatives under the Reform 2020 is to get this kind of information to people earlier so that they're looking at developing services that keep them in their home rather than going into the more costly high-intensive care situation.
Madam Chair, correct. We have some strategies embedded in Reform 2020 which try to identify earlier older Minnesotans and family members who, if we could get to earlier, would be able to relieve some of the stress and keep people healthier and independent longer.
Okay, I think I'm going to just say you got 2 minutes.
Okay, all right. Topics that you may want to consider for future discussions. Reform 2020, and there's a whole host of those that you will hear about, enhancing our adult protection system, looking at how we serve people who are vent dependent in the community, first contact, which is what you've referenced, how do we get to people earlier and partner with clinics and other parts of where older Minnesotans are interacting, some crisis diversion, the community first services and supports. It's a major feature of Reform 2020, where we are trying to go to the next generation of what you currently know as the PCA or the Personal Care Assistance Program. How can we make it more flexible, more consumer-driven, more cost-effective, et cetera? You'll see some topics within Reform 2020 about work and how to support people with disabilities to achieve competitive employment, et cetera. Another area, the disability rate setting system that you referenced earlier, and the standards, provider standards, and quality initiatives. This is part of our compliance plan with the federal government. We've been working over the last year with stakeholders to come to as much agreement as we can about how we're going to pay for disability services, how we're going to monitor that quality, license providers, et cetera. We will talk about that. Own your future. Long-term care planning, how we as a state can help people plan earlier for their long-term care needs. Major initiative of the Lieutenant Governor as well as the Commissioner. We should talk about that at some point in time. Olmstead, I mentioned. Autism. We have a couple different work groups that are circling on some recommendations and some decisions around autism services, how to serve children with autism better. We should talk about that at some point in time and where the state can be of more support. And then last on my list is Alzheimer's, dementia, to talk about what the collaborations that have been developed over the last couple of years, be it Prepare Minnesota 2020, or now I think the acronym is ACT Now, or something similar to that, which is really trying to address a growing need with our not only older Minnesotans, but their families, and the impact upon the families trying to care and support for their family member with dementia. So those are some topics that I think deserve some policy discussion and deliberation. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Senator Rosen has a question, if you're ready.
Actually, Madam Chair, it's directed towards the conversation, but more towards you. A lot of reference to the 2020 reforms going forward, and I suppose I could do my own homework. Are we going to have a review on those 2020?
Yes, we are.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Just a moment. We have that on our list, and it may be very soon. We don't want to commit to a day yet, but it may be very soon. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
You
did a great job. There's a lot to go over, and we didn't give it's just such a huge area. We can't give enough time, but let me invite Assistant Commissioner Scott Lights. You must need at least a gallon of water for all the talking that you've been doing in front of committees. I think this is my third time with you. I look forward to your comments. You've heard me say, if you can give us just the general, and I think people might have a lot of questions for you, but I can tell you that I was at the presentation, was that last night? Time goes so quickly. Was that just last night on the exchange? And if you weren't there, you ought to watch the video of it. It is was the best, most comprehensive, understandable discussion I have heard yet on the Accountable Care Act. It took, and I appreciate very much, something that everybody wants to say is so complex that you can't understand it, and talked about it in a way that it is perfectly understandable, and we don't have to get all agitated and anxious about not understanding it. If you present like that to us from the department, then we can spend our energy on trying to resolve the issues that were raised in it rather than worrying about whether or not we understand the language. So thank you for that. And I look forward to you doing that now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Scott Lights. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at DHS. And I will, Madam Chair, try to do a very kind of higher level run through. I think you have a copy of the slides I'll be working off of with the healthcare program's overview. Just very briefly, the healthcare administration within DHS has responsibility for overseeing the state's Medicaid program. We do that by working in the eligibility area, determining eligibility, administering benefits on behalf of the clients we serve, determining and setting payment rates for our providers, contracting and purchasing for healthcare services through the managed care organizations we work with, providing customer assistance to our enrollees and claims processing systems for the providers that serve our clients, as well as measuring and evaluating how well we're doing in the work that is occurring. Minnesota's public health care programs, there's really two of them I'll talk about. The first is the medical assistance program, or what traditionally is thought of as Medicaid, and this was established for lower-income individuals to receive health care services. We enroll approximately 768,000 people in that program. And the Minnesota Care Program, which is a state-subsidized program that has benefits very similar to what the Medicaid program has for the clients, but people who are enrolled in the program typically pay a premium to be on that program. And we also supplement the Medicare program through our Medicaid program. Medicare is the program for elderly persons in the United States, but there's some cost sharing in that program. So for lower-income elderly people, the Medicaid program serves as a program that helps to offset some of that cost sharing.
I'm impressed.
Both the Minnesota Care Program and the Medical Assistance Program operate under the federal framework where we participate and partner with the federal government. They pay half the cost of the program. We pay half the cost of the program. And we have that split. More specifically on Medicaid, moving to slide six, I guess page six. Medicaid is at least on my slide page six.
It's probably page three, slide six.
Page three, thank you. Is a public health care program for individuals and families who have lower incomes. Again, it's jointly funded by the federal government and the state government. The program really operates under a broad framework set out by the federal government or our partners more directly with the federal government, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. And then states have some requirements that they need to meet, but also some flexibility underneath that. And I'm just going to put a term out there just so you know it. It's called the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, or the FMAP, and that refers to the percentage of the cost of the Medicaid program that's paid for by the federal government as opposed to the state. And in Minnesota, that FMAP percentage is 50%. On the next slide, the federal government does require Medicaid programs cover certain categories of individuals and services. But beyond that, states do have some flexibility in the design and implementation of their programs. For example, we there are certain benefits that we have to cover, but there are optional benefits. I'll get to what those are in a moment. We also set payment rates for the Medicaid program at the state level, as opposed to the Medicare program, which is set more at the federal level. We do call our program in Minnesota statutorily the Medical Assistance Program for Medicaid. And when we talk about Minnesota Care, we often refer to that also as part of the Medicaid program because we really operate the Minnesota Care program underneath what's called a federal Section 1115 waiver that allows us to operate that program essentially under the Medicaid rules and regulations and to receive federal matching funds for that program. We finance Medicaid in Minnesota through a combination of the general fund expenditures and the federal matching portion of the program. And we have eligibility levels which are set for children, pregnant women, and parents, as well as persons who are over 65 and older, blind, and disabled. And I've listed those on this next slide. I won't go into those ones other than to say we sort of cover folks generally up to 100% of poverty, but with some exceptions, kids, for example, up to 18, up to 150% of poverty. And then the Minnesota Care Program, which I'll describe in just a minute, really covers folks above that level. On the next slide is a listing of the services that we're required to cover under the Medicaid program. And it's things that you would anticipate, physician services, hospital services, nursing facility services. On the next slide is listed the services which are optional but that we do cover in Minnesota. I think this list sometimes surprises people to see how many things are actually optional under the federal law that most people would consider somewhat necessary, things like pharmacy services, mental health services, dental services, and other things. So there's a listing of those things. We cover those benefits, but they are optional and not required by the federal government for us to do so.
Assistant Commissioner, but are they 50-50 cut? It doesn't require us to pay the total cost.
Madam Chair, thanks for that clarification. The services that were covered, they're optional, but if a state chooses to cover those benefits, the cost is shared with the federal government on those.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. And then may I just ask you one other question, this sort of back on your slide 8, where you're talking about ME populations that are fully state-funded, which are certain residents of institutions for mental illness. Can you talk about that? Because I was hearing earlier that we were making some movement in getting the federal government, or at least we're working on movement, to getting them to participate in the cost of state-operated services.
Madam Chair, I can talk a little bit about it. I have to admit that my depth of knowledge on that particular point isn't real deep, but what I can tell you is that traditionally the federal government has not allowed for institutes of mental disease to have match federal share or federal match associated with that. I don't know all the history on that piece of it. I know that in our Reform 2020 waiver, there is some movement or a request as part of that waiver to receive some funding for services that are related to IMDs, and I think that might be what you're referring to in your question. And so we're, as part of that discussion, we'll be having that discussion. You know, it's our perspective that by having folks able to receive services, we're able to actually lower costs overall for the system, and that the federal government benefits from that, and so they should be participating in that.
I can't understand. Do you know why if they're eligible for the program simply because they move in a new institution, they're not covering their care costs?
Madam Chair, undoubtedly there are folks in the agency who could answer that question very well. Unfortunately, I'm not one of them. So
that's okay. I'm sure the answer is money. So
we'd be happy to do a little follow-up on that for you. Very briefly, the next slide just lays out what enrollment and costs are for the Medicaid program in kind of a graphical form. And I'll only note that obviously the cost associated on a per capita basis with different populations varies based on what that population is. Our families and kids population is a relatively inexpensive population, although it's the majority of our enrollment, whereas the elderly and disabled proportion of the Medicaid program is actually relatively small, but is actually quite expensive because of the types of individuals who are receiving services. They're disabled individuals who have high health needs. I'll next turn and talk about the Minnesota Care program. Minnesota Care was created in 1992, and it was created as a program to really fill the gap that existed between where Medicaid eligibility ended and where job-based coverage typically took place. So it was sort of for folks who are working, but maybe were sole proprietors, they were farmers, they were others who didn't have job-based coverage available to them. We've operated that program since 1992, and in 1995 started to receive federal matching funds for that program, both for our families and kids and then later on for our single adult populations. So we essentially are operating that as a Medicaid program. We finance Minnesota Care on the next slide through state payments from the Healthcare Access Fund. This is a fund that was also created in 1992 to provide funding for Minnesota Care, and we pay for that fund via a 2% tax on healthcare providers and a 1% tax on HMOs and nonprofit health corporations. The majority of the funding for the program comes from that, but also people do pay premiums. Everyone on the program is paying a premium, or many of the people on the program pay premiums. The average premium is around $23 a month. You know, as your income rises, the higher proportion of your income you pay. We also receive federal matching funds, which accounts for about 28% of the funding for the program. We do cover kids and parents in that program up to 275% of poverty, and adults without children up to 200% of poverty through that program. And we also have a number of a few populations that we pay for out of the Minnesota Care program that are fully state funded. The people who are enrolled in what's called the Minnesota Healthy Contribution Program, which covers people between 200 and 250% of poverty to provide a subsidy to them to buy private coverage. Lawfully present non-citizens who do not qualify for federal funding due to their immigration status, and then legal guardians and foster parents.
Assistant Commissioner, Senator Hoffman has a question, if you'd be willing to take it now.
Of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, one of the things I want to ask you about is when you're looking at the MA, the Katie Beckett waiver or TEFRA in Minnesota, allows families to buy into medical assistance or MA provisions. Are your numbers that are in the slide here on both on page 6 and as well as looking at page 4, slide 8, do those include the TEFRA dollars, TEFRA numbers as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, they do.
Follow up.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, maybe I could get those a better breakout, just to kind of give a good picture of just how TEFRA benefits families in need in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, we'd be happy to get that to you.
Thank you. Would you distribute that to all of the community?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
On the Minnesota Care side, moving to benefits really covers very similar benefits to what you see in the Medicaid program. So the only thing I'll pause to mention on this is that we do in the Minnesota Care program for certain populations, our single adult populations and some of our upper income parents have a cap of hospitalization at $10,000. That's been in the program for a long period of time and is something that we'll want to take a look at, I think, as we think about kind of the future of what Minnesota Care might look like.
Assistant Commissioner, on that, are you going to move off of Minnesota Care now?
I just had one more slide left on that, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Only to say that the enrollment in Minnesota Care, we cover about 127,000 people in that program, split about two-thirds families and kids, one-third single adults, and spend on an annual basis right around $650 million on the program.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner, we have done an early expansion into up to 75% of poverty, and we have a bill that's been introduced now that will increase that to 133 with a 5% set aside up to about 138% of poverty. That group, with that expansion, we are drawing down federal dollars. We get access to some federal dollars. That group right now is covered under Minnesota Care, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And so then they will not be covered under Minnesota Care. They will go into Medicaid. So that will save some money in what is now a provider tax or a premium tax, and it allows more money to be utilized for other programs as long as that's in place, correct? And that's one of the resources that we will use then for the basic, what would be next. The rest of the Minnesota Care Program, if that continues with modifications, as you've indicated, or some new form of basic health plan, that's a decision, a policy discussion that we're going to have here. And that next section that goes up to 200% of poverty, I think, is the funding stream for that. Does that have – oh, I remember now. It is the tax, you know, it's the medical resource or the financial resources that would be given to people to buy down their health plan on an exchange would be gathered and used then to underwrite that basic health plan up to 200%. Is that correct? And then would we continue to need something beyond that? We do for children. We're going to try to expand up to 275% for children. But then there, then it's up to us what we want to do past that, if anything. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think you've captured that well. And obviously, as you've described, there's a number of moving parts here. As we expand Medicaid for children up to 275% of poverty, we believe we have to do that because of the maintenance of effort requirements. Those are kids who are currently eligible for our program, so there will be a cost associated with doing that from a state perspective. If we do the expansion up to 133 with the 5% discount, 138, those people are currently, as you mentioned, enrolled in Minnesota Care Program at 50% federal match, 50% state. The expansion allows us to move those individuals to fully federally funded coverage, which saves money, as you've noted, to the Healthcare Access Fund because we no longer have to do a 50-50 match. That's all federally funded. There's a savings associated with that. It nets out to a net positive for the state when you sort of do the math on those two. Question then becomes for the folks above 133 of poverty, you can move them into the exchange where they would just receive, as you've noted, federal advanced premium tax credits for their coverage. There are concerns that some have raised that they may that the cost sharing associated with some of those policies, especially for lower income folks, may not be very affordable for them. And so, if we want to continue the Minnesota Care Program, what we would be asking the federal government for through the basic health plan option that I think you've mentioned would really be, as you've said, 95% of what we otherwise would have been getting, those other people would have otherwise been getting for their subsidies in the exchange. That would be given to the state to continue to operate the program. And depending on what the benefit set levels are and the payment rates within the new Minnesota Care Program funded by a basic health plan financing mechanism look like, would really be dependent on how many additional state resources might be necessary to pay for that. And that's all part of, I think, going to be part of the discussion moving forward as we get additional guidance from the federal government and we come forth with a budget page next week on that issue.
I look forward to that. This committee will put their heads down and really try to grasp what the implications are of staying on the exchange, because that's where you get into these various colored plans, bronze, silver, gold. And if someone's purchasing, especially low-income persons, they go for the least expensive, but it may in the long run not really be a kind of plan that accomplishes the goals that we want for people to be having access to health care. So I look forward to more discussion about that. Is there anybody who would like to ask anything further about that right now? Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about kind of eligibility and how we do those determinations currently, and then how that's going to change under the federal law, just so you have some grounding in that. Right now, financial eligibility for medical assistance in Minnesota care is really based on income and, in some cases, on the assets that an individual has. And we do the determinations a little bit differently depending on whether it's Medicaid or Minnesota care. For Medicaid, income eligibility is determined separately for each household member who's requesting coverage. And the client's net income is used to determine eligibility for the Medicaid program. For Minnesota care, it's gross household income that's used to determine eligibility. So we have a little bit different way of determining that, and that's statutorily based in terms of what those look like. The next slide just gives you, I'm not going to spend any time, and it just says what kind of what the poverty levels are. So we oftentimes talk about programs operating in percents of poverty and wanted to at least have that information in front of you. But one of the things that the Affordable Care Act is going to require us to do as we move forward on implementing the program is starting in January of 2014, we will have new eligibility and enrollment requirements put in place. And so the way that we're now determining eligibility will actually change for a large number of our populations. There'll be a new way to count income, some streamlined online applications and verification processes, improved processes for renewal, and then some other eligibility changes to maintain coverage. I can obviously go into a great deal of detail. If you'd like, I can, I'll try to cover these at a very high level very briefly for you. The main thing I'll maybe spend a couple minutes on is just to talk about the new method to count income. Collectively, we talk about these new eligibility rules as and they're oftentimes referred to as the MAGI rules. And that's because they're called for MAGI. And it's really the modified gross, adjusted gross income rules because they are based on a modified version of the income tax rules that are currently in place and adjusted gross income. So under the new rules, household membership and income will be determined using the same rules used for income tax purposes. Members of a household and the income counted for Medicaid eligibility purposes will be basically the same household members and types of income that are used when you file a tax return. So it'll look different than it looks today. It'll be really using this MAGI methodology. In addition, all the asset requirements that were currently there and any income disregards that are currently there are eliminated. And the various existing income disregards are replaced by a single standard across the board 5 percentage point income disregard that you mentioned earlier. This also means for us eliminating, you know, the asset tests that we currently have in place for our parents. I think I will move to the next slide, which really talks, and again, at a very high level. The main thing I'll highlight here is that we will be streamlining and requiring, we're required to actually start accepting applications online, which is going to be very good for clients, something we should have done and should have done probably a while back, but the law is requiring it, and I think we're finally having the IT infrastructure to be able to do that. The other thing I'll just highlight on this slide is that we currently evaluate persons for coverage every 6 months. The federal law will require us to move that to 12 months. And so basically what that will mean is you'll have longer periods of eligibility and redeterminations that are made annually as opposed to biannually for coverage. Some people will probably stay on our programs as a result of that. And then hospitals will be allowed to do what's called presumptive eligibility, where they are able to screen clients as they come, individuals as they come in, and make presumptive determinations about whether they are eligible for Medicaid so that it ensures payment for the hospital while the process is going on to do actual determination of their eligibility.
Assistant Commissioner, is there an issue with renewal changes at 12 months, 6 months to 12 months, about changes in income level? In the last 6 months, you know, we are faster, so we see the changes quickly. So if it changes to 12 months and there's an income change, that there's a penalty back on a group of people who are pretty impoverished already. That is an issue that people have been raising and asking me about.
Madam Chair, I think the an area where that would be particularly where it particularly comes up will be within the federal health exchanges, and as folks get their advanced premium tax credits through the exchange, and that there will need to be there's a requirement of a review of the income levels and the subsidies that were received and sort of a settle up, and I think there's a concern that as folks' incomes change within the exchange. That might be problematic for individuals who have enrolled in through the exchange. So that's an issue, frankly, that we also have concerns about, and that's part of the discussion, frankly, with the federal government right now. Is we don't actually think it's fair to subject lower income individuals to some of those issues. It may make more sense to try to maintain the Minnesota Care Program where we wouldn't have that issue ongoing and to allow us to use the BHP Basic Health Plan funding for us to continue the program. So that's very much part of that same discussion, I believe, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
We've already covered a little bit on the on things moving forward. So I'll just close, if it's fine, Madam Chair, with a little bit around kind of the choices that I think this you all as a legislature will be looking at this year. Obviously, I think I've mentioned one bucket of them already, which are the requirements that we make a number of changes to our eligibility and income counting ways of doing business within the Medicaid program. Those are things that are required by the ACA, so we'll be bringing forth those in the governor's budget moving forward. We also, you will all have the opportunity to take a look at the early Medicaid the Medicaid expansion, and we have the option at a state level to expand Medicaid or not up to 133% for single adults. That'll be another issue that'll be before you. Obviously, there's some financial incentive to do that because we get full federal funding for a number of years to do that. And then the third issue is really what do we do for folks above 138 of poverty. And I think you, Madam Chair, you've kind of capsulized, I think, a number of the discussions. We can optionally move those people into the exchange where they'll receive advanced premium tax credits. Again, some folks are concerned about the affordability for people, especially below 200 of poverty in the exchange, and some of the settle-up issues that you just raised. Or we could continue down the road of pursuing the continuation of the Minnesota Care Program, which we've successfully operated the last 20 years in Minnesota, and work with the federal government around finding a stable financing source for us to do that in a way that doesn't disadvantage us as a state. And I think that's certainly an active discussion that we're having right now with the federal government. And so we look forward to continuing to work with you and keeping you informed and involved in those discussions moving forward. We've worked very closely with CMS. We met with them last Friday at a very high level to talk about our desires. We will continue those discussions and have sort of told them by the February forecast, which means basically by the end of February, we really do have to have some finalization around what their positions are going to be and what they're able to offer us so you all can make informed decisions about our programs moving forward.
Fabulous. Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Leitz, the information on the Health Care Access Fund that you sent, I requested at that meeting a couple days ago. The fund is fine this year. Next year, I think it goes down to 23, 24 million, and then it goes up to over 200 million by 2015, 2016. Is that one question? Is that where, if we leave Minnesota Care as is, right? That's where it's at. If you if you plan on continuing on along with the exchange, do you have any figures? Do you have an idea what Minnesota Care is going to look like if we decide to keep that ongoing?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we have been looking at that issue, obviously, and so there's a few things that are going on. One is that if we were to continue Minnesota Care, we obviously need to make some benefit changes to the program, hospital cap and other things. The effect of the, but from an enrollment perspective and a cost perspective, the effect of the requirement that people have health insurance coverage has an impact because we start to see additional people coming into the program who might not otherwise have enrolled in the program. And so we have a bump up in enrollment if we were to keep Minnesota Care around. Obviously, you have those same people, they'd be moving into the exchange. So they're in one way or another, they're coming into coverage. And so that obviously impacts on the affordability question. And so that's why the role that the federal government plays in this becomes a very important question, because if we were just to receive funding at our current match rate and we had all these additional people coming into the program, that would have a very high cost for the state because we're paying half the bill in that case. I mean, these are all newly eligible, you know, people who are coming in. If, however, we are able to work with the federal government to receive funding that would be kind of the equivalent or a little less than the equivalent of what they would have otherwise received for those individuals in the exchange, then we're able to kind of think about operating the program with that funding and have money to then we'd have to make some decisions at a state level around what the benefit set looks like and, you know, what provider payment levels look like and to decide how much additional funding, or if any, we would need to kind of operate the Minnesota Care program moving forward, which then impacts on what funding source we'd like to use to do that. So I think all these are kind of nested questions, but they all do have an impact on kind of how we want to finance it, do we need to finance it moving forward. But obviously, I think from our perspective, continuing Minnesota Care at the current match rates is challenging just from a fiscal perspective because of the 50-50 requirement that we might otherwise need to operate with.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair. We need some answers from the feds fairly soon to get this. I mean, this is crazy.
In order to make decisions about this next group pass 138% up to 200%, we need to know. And we're all working very hard to put a little pressure to get that answered before March. Our partners, the insurance industry, needs to have that information in order to design the product. And so I think we're all pushing very hard to make that case. But this will be part of this committee's discussion about what we want to do with that next group, and hopefully we get the money that would have gone into the exchange at a 95% level. If we want to make it 100%, how do we fund it? What does it comprise? Will all be a part of what's put in front of us as we're pursuing our adaptation to the Affordable Care Act. So, and is there any further questions? Thank you very much. Let's see, where are we at here? Okay, thank you very much. Our last presentation is from Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry. Hello again, on the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And again, I just would ask, we have just 20 minutes. Oh, no, according to that. No, we have a little more than that according to my watch. But if you can, as you understand, my goal would be to allow members of the committee to have a chance to focus questions and focus you on their area of interest. I think people are pretty familiar with this subject. So if you give us a sort of a 50,000-foot look, and then we'll get some questions for you. Thank you.
Very good, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and with me is Nancy Johnston. She is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. We're both here today to respond to questions that you may have, and in the interest of staying at 50,000 feet, what I'll do is just really, I guess, put the program into some context. At the current time, as you may know, the state is engaged in settlement discussions with the federal district court. At least 65 separate suits had been brought against the agency for things like conditions of confinement for those people who had been committed to us in the sex offender treatment program. All those cases were brought together into a class action suit, and we're doing our best to try to respond to those issues that the agency can respond to. On the other hand, there are many, many issues that will require legislative action, hopefully in the upcoming year. So the task force is doing its work. We also have an evaluation team that is looking at specific treatment issues, moving from one phase of treatment to the next. That's another claim that has been brought against the program. But I think probably one of the best roadmaps out there or pieces of information out there is the work of the legislative auditor from 2 years ago that laid out really background and context about the program, the sex offender treatment program, and how to move forward with that program. So I would, for those of you who haven't taken a look at it, I would commend it to your reading. It really is, I think, an excellent piece of work, really critically looking at all of the parts of this system and how they do or don't work. We've used that roadmap to try to address some of the issues inside of our program, but you know, there are still many issues that need to be addressed. Just very, very basically, I think one of the biggest issues in front of us as a department is the growing population in the program. If you look at the second page of the handout that we provided, you can see that in June of 2008, we were at 483 clients. If projections hold as they have for the last number of years, we will be at 826 clients in June of 2015. You can see the cost associated with the program. It's a very expensive treatment program. This is not considered a forecasted program, so you will be seeing a request for increases.
Assistant Commissioner, may I say, just in case there's someone in the committee that doesn't understand what you're saying about forecasted, it means that if you have 150 persons that you're serving, that's what you're funded for. But you may, without any control over it, be asked to serve 175 persons. So we aren't able to forecast based on what has happened in the past, what the growth of the program is. You're not allowed to do that. So if you are asked to serve more than you're funded for, you have to come back in and ask for funding for that.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And these commitments happen at the county level. They are generally people who are finishing their term with the Department of Corrections. There's an end of confinement. There's a risk assessment or review at the end of confinement. There's a determination done by the Department of Corrections, which is then shared with the counties, who then make a determination about continued civil commitment. So we don't control the number of clients who come to our program. I think that will be clearly a matter for discussion in the upcoming legislative session. The task force that is looking at issues around sex offender treatment and sex offender placement certainly will have recommendations about that.
And Assistant Commissioner, may I just, sorry for interrupting you, but we as the legislators often hear from our county partners about the frustration they feel about being asked to share in the costs of the persons who are committed. It's certainly in the beginning of the program, but when we get into that debate or discussion about what role should the county be playing in funding this, its origins is in an effort on the part of the state. I'm asking, not declaring, but is in rooted in this discussion that you're having now, which is sharing, because we don't have control, we can maybe influence the decision making by asking for county participation. Is that a valid statement?
Madam Chair, I think that's a very accurate statement. It is the county that has control and responsibility for advancing the commitment. And the other thing that you'll find in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report is that there is a wide variance across this state and the numbers that are committed on a county-by-county basis. And so there were some choices being made at the county level. And so this that share that went from 10% of the cost to now 25% of the total cost was really intended, I think, by the legislature 2 years ago to represent, that approach or philosophy that, in fact, it was counties who had control over the commitment of people to this program, and it wasn't the state that had the control of who came to our program or not. I think that the other important things to know, and I'm sure you'll get more detailed when over the course of this upcoming session, but we have two locations where treatment is provided. One is in Moose Lake, one is in St. Peter. People who are in Moose Lake are generally in their early phases of treatment. They have just been committed to us. They're at an assessment phase, or they're either refusing treatment or in the early stages, maybe phase one of treatment, maybe phase two as well. As we move to the St. Peter campus, we serve people who are much further along in their treatment, and it is from there that somebody would be moved into the community when appropriate. Again, this decision to move someone to the community is outside of the control of the Department of Human Services. That is a decision that is made by the Supreme Court Appeal Panel. Our job really in this system, which is a big job but is somewhat limited, is once somebody is committed to us, our job is to make sure we move them through phases of treatment to successfully reduce risk so that people can return to the community when appropriate, and in such a way that we've really mitigated future risk of perpetration of violence, particularly sexual violence against other members of the community. So that's the big picture. You have some detail here. Again, the Office of Legislative Auditor's report is just an exceptional piece of work about the entirety of the system. And again, many of those issues we've addressed. I don't know if there's anything else.
Well, thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We'll open up for questions, but I have asked our committee administrator, Chelsea, is going to be sending a link to that auditor's report to everybody. If you'd like to have access to it, you can pull it up online.
And if I could, just one change in the last year. In 2012, we did have our first provisional discharge of one client who has moved into the community. He's been there. He's been successfully living in. First, he was in the Golden Valley community. He's now in Minneapolis. And we've done both community notification meetings. The second one didn't garner anywhere near the amount of attention the first one did. But it's slow, very slow progress. But we now know that we can, that there are structures in place in the community where we can safely place and supervise clients on their path back to community placement.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you. I just would note that you're representing, if we talk about a continuum of care and then narrow it down to the care of sexual health, you know, promoting sexual health and trying to diminish sexual violence, you're at the very far end of the continuum, and you're here representing those parts of the state's initiatives in this area that deal with those who have already committed crimes, persons who have already served time, and who are then civilly committed and in your care for treatment post-corrections. There are questions that have come up about in your discussions with corrections about shifting or moving some of the treatment over into the corrections system. So I'd like you to talk about what those conversations have been and what the probability and barriers are. That has to do with that when you civilly commit, I'm sure everybody in this committee knows that, we're talking about taking a person that has been in a correction system that is licensed under a completely different set of expectations and standards and putting him in a hospital system that has to meet all of the obligations that are quite a higher level of expectation than a correction system in terms of staffing, et cetera. So that's why the cost becomes so high. Even though of our overall Department of Human Services budget, this is comprises about a percentage, right, in terms of the whole. We are trying to look at how to impact that 1% by moving some of the care maybe over to the correction system. For this group of people that is at the very far end of the continuum, but I'm hoping that somewhere along the course of time that we're going to be talking about what we are willing to do in real prevention services. That's before we have a victim of any kind of sexual crime, whether it's sexual assault or intrafamilial inappropriate behaviors or juveniles engaged in inappropriate behavior. Way before that, where the family is strengthened in terms of understanding when they're beginning to do boundary violations. At a level that's not yet illegal, but is clearly a precursor to a generational breakdown and eventual violence against the community in some form. So I just want to be clear to the committee that we're talking right here. You're only talking about the very, very end, what I call the caboose on a train, a long train of deterioration that's occurred. And it's where we have to spend a ton of money. But we could maybe be doing some interventions much earlier that over time would diminish this escalation that you're having in terms of dealing with this problem. So the question underneath all of that was about corrections. What, if anything, at this end of the continuum are we looking at to reduce those costs to the Department of Human Services budget?
Madam Chair, I'll ask Nancy to assist me with this question, but I will start by saying that we do have an agreement with and a contract with the Department of Corrections. We work very closely with them. In fact, some of the sex offender treatment that is provided in corrections is led by the approach from the Department of Human Services, and we can provide certainly greater detail. I also wanted to follow up. We are licensed as a supervised living facility at the Moose Lake facility. It's something we've been talking to the Department of Health about. You know, as the licensee, it's not our place, I guess, to suggest what the appropriate license should be, but it doesn't really fit closely with the kind of services we provide, and there's just so many variances associated with it. That might have some impact on the cost of services, but I do think highly concentrated clinical treatment is very expensive. Wherever you provide it. So maybe, Nancy, you can talk a little bit about any agreements we have with corrections.
Sure. In the Department of Corrections, to my knowledge, they have approximately 300 treatment beds for those sex offenders in their system who have not yet reached expiration and aren't moving out the door. When the task force first convened, that was one of the very first things we talked about. Commissioner Roy addressed that there really aren't very many beds within the correctional system.
Can you approach the mic? Thank
Sorry.
You.
There aren't.
Did you give your your name, by the way?
I'm sorry.
Did you give your name? I didn't hear it.
But Madam Chair, Nancy Johnston, Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Thank you.
So in the Department of Corrections, there are a very small number, relatively speaking, out of 10,000 inmates. I believe there are around 300 treatment beds specifically for sex offenders in their system. So that is one area that the task force has had some discussion about in terms of possibly talking about increasing those beds in their system, because that's a very small number of men that are being treated prior to being considered, if they are, for civil commitment.
Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, that's great. You know, we have here, I was worried about getting done on time. We could have let the children's component go a little longer. Extend my apologies to her for rushing her along. We'll have her back again to talk more about her program. So is there anything else? My committee administrator has pointed to is number 3, that the meeting shall adjourn. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.